Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. Seeing one of the state's many wild creatures up close is a fascinating thrill that many of us enjoy. But when bears, foxes, coyotes, and other wild animals get a little too close for comfort, that can present a range of challenges, both for humans and for the animals themselves. As the landscape in Wisconsin changes, communities grow, and construction of new residential developments continue, wild animals are inevitably affected and trying to adapt to their new environment as best they can. This can mean a variety of wildlife are venturing into areas they never have before. In springtime and early summer, many animals are more visible as they're out and about, gathering food for their growing families. In a perfect world, animals would know the boundaries of which areas of land are preserved for them, but the reality is these creatures are just doing their best to survive. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shireen Seewert. Today we take a look at the best ways to avoid conflicts while coexisting with wild animals now found in every corner of the state. We'll discuss their behavior patterns, the laws regulating hunting and trapping, and what to do if animals are causing problems or property damage, whether you're at home in an urban setting or on a camping or hiking adventure. We'll also learn what to do if a wild animal comes in direct contact with you or a pet and how to prevent these encounters from happening in the first place. Brad Cooley has been with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources for more than 20 years after graduating from the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point with a degree in general resource management. He spent 6 years working in the DNR's Big Game Program, which manages deer, bear, and elk, and was promoted to his current position of Wildlife Damage Specialist in 2007. Brad, welcome to Route 51.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Adrian Weideman is a wildlife manager in eastern Wisconsin, was that in the 1980s, managing habitat on state wildlife areas before he headed up the wolf recovery and management efforts in the state. After 33 years with the DNR, his conservation efforts continued, first as Timber Wolf Alliance coordinator, now as wildlife biologist with Wisconsin's Green Fire. Adrian, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate it.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Brad, what's the most common wildlife complaint you see at the DNR?
Well, it varies depending on the time of year. You know, this time of year, bear are very active. We have a bear that's down, been observed a few times now in Washington, Racine, and Waukesha County. So that's getting a lot of attention right now. But, you know, by far, I think the biggest complaint we get is deer. You know, we have such a healthy and robust deer population. They're scattered throughout the state. So a lot of people, you know, dealing with some of the negative impacts of that healthy deer population.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of deer in the Wausau area, too, right in the city. It seems like they're walking down the street half the time. It's been crazy. So a question for you, Adrian. Do you think that animals and humans can peacefully coexist, even in these urban settings?
I think so. We're demonstrating that in many places, and we're seeing in urban areas actually quite a growth of wildlife populations. When I was young, we never considered deer an urban wildlife or coyotes an urban wildlife. And now most of our large urban areas have these as regular wildlife species, as well as turkeys and many other species, which at times can cause some conflict. But we're seeing that a lot of our urban areas are becoming refuges for many wildlife species.
And Brad, besides the obvious deer and the occasional bear, what are some of the common wild animals you might encounter in an urban area, in a city?
Yeah, a lot of them. You know, raccoons, a lot of people deal with raccoon issues, you know, getting into the attic or just observing them. You know, there's always fox and coyote observations and sightings within urban areas. You know, the regular skunk, everyone, obviously, most people smell the presence of a skunk, you know, so skunks, possums, you know, like Adrian mentioned, kind of turkeys are kind of a new up and coming urban species that we're dealing with more frequently now. So, yeah, there's a whole variety of wildlife, you know, species that are found in urban areas. And obviously people need to learn to coexist and you know, take precautionary measures to avoid conflicts with them.
Which of those are carnivores, which are omnivores or herbivores? And what's the difference between those labels? Just so we're clear on that, Brad.
Yeah, so carnivore obviously is an animal that eats primarily meat or meat, you know, and that's, you know, the big ones are, you know, probably fox and coyotes and wolves, although those species will, you know, eat fruits and nuts on occasion as well. But, you know, and then you got your omnivores, which eat both meat and plants. You know, there's a variety of those out there. And then your omnivores are just plant eaters. So, yeah, you know, a lot of food preferences out there among the animals, and you need to know that so we can take those precautionary measures to prevent conflicts.
Well, when we're camping or hiking, we rather expect to come across wildlife, but it seems like foxes, bear, and deer are more prevalent in urban areas, as we just said. What contributes to this migration to areas that are clearly unsuitable for wildlife? Adrian, what are wild animals even doing in a city?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say they're unsuitable. They're probably, they have their own habitat and niches that wildlife can fit into. And traditionally, urban areas are places where, like, rabbits and squirrels did quite well because there aren't predators there. And the predators eventually figured out those are places they can find food sources. So there is a mixture of habitat, and especially in our suburbs and ex-urban areas where we see a lot of shrubbery and herbaceous plants and perennial plants, and all of that can provide habitat for wildlife. So we're seeing a lot of places in urban areas where wildlife can exist, and they're not being hunted there, so they have that protection there as well.
And how are they meeting their dietary needs when they're not in their, what we'd think of as their natural habitat? What are they feeding on?
Well, some of the things they're feeding on are things that garden plants, ornamental plants, the lawn grasses. Those are the kind of things that we'd be planting around our yards. Some of them might include native plants, and it's always a good idea to include native plants from just a pollinator standpoint and the berries that support the native birds in our area. But it's going to be a mixture of those native plants and exotic plants, and sometimes other food sources. The cat food or dog food that's left outside, or scraps that get dropped outside, become foods for some of our omnivores and predators, and that can be one of the factors that occasionally causes problems.
Brad, does urban sprawl have anything to do with this, the increase that we're seeing in the animals in our cities?
Yeah, certainly. You know, as development occurs, obviously you're you know, developing or moving into that habitat and areas that are traditionally, you know, occupied by wild animals. And, you know, a lot of the dwellings right now or the you know, developments have, you know, planned green spaces and places that are good for wildlife, you know, whether it's, you know, small woodlots or whether it's, you know, drainage and retention ponds, things like that. You know, those type of features create excellent habitat for some wildlife species. So, yeah, as you see that development occur, especially in those traditionally, you know, wooded or undeveloped areas, you're going to increase that you know, that wildlife interface and between humans and life.
What impact is that having on cities? I guess my question is, are you seeing more reports of attacks by animals, whether they're attacks on pets or humans? Have there been increased reports of that, Brad?
Yeah, in most cases, no. You know, it hasn't been necessarily an increase in attacks. You know, we do occasionally hear of coyotes, you know, particularly during mating season in January, February, where, you know, they'll get more territorial and they'll attack a pet dog. You know, so you do hear about those examples. But in most cases, it's just general nuisance complaints about, you know, deer eating, you know, ornamental plantings, you know, like geese feces on athletic fields and sidewalks. So in most cases, it's not, you know, at a level where we're seeing attacks and stuff, but it's more those kind of secondary or lower grade impacts that people are having when they're conflicting with wildlife.
Adrian, when foxes migrate to urban areas, where do they usually live? And can they be scared away, or is that a bad idea?
I'm sure they can be scared away or hazed away from areas where you don't want them. But wherever there's any kind of shrubbery or growth of vegetation, sometimes under old abandoned buildings, culverts can be used as den sites. Usually any kind of plantings can provide some kind of habitat. They are probably shy and try to avoid presence of people, but at the same time, An urbanized area might be a place where coyotes can't find them because the coyotes are kind of avoiding more intensely urbanized areas. So sometimes it's just places where they can avoid other predators as long as they can still find food. If there's cottontail, rabbits, if there's mice and rats using the area, and sometimes even foods that are dropped off by people, there's going to be enough food there. If there's enough cover there in the way of shrubbery and plantings that they can use for cover, they can find homes in those kind of places.
Do they present any kind of danger to humans, but I guess more specifically pets? And I'm asking this because there was a post on Nextdoor just this week saying, keep your cats and small dogs inside because there have been foxes all over the neighborhood. Is that a real concern?
Probably for cats, there might be a chance for an encounter. I think coyotes are probably a greater risk for cats, but a fox might encounter a cat. It'd have to be a very small dog because the foxes are as small as dogs. So most dogs would probably not have too much of a risk. I guess one possible concern would be if they have rabies, and foxes can carry rabies. So anytime a wild animal, a wild mammal bites a domestic animal, is the risk of spreading rabies. And that's probably the greatest concern. But I suppose cat owners, there would be some risk if you let your cat outside, which a lot is not a good idea anyway, that they could encounter an animal such as a fox.
Wolves, what's the range of wolves? Do we ever see wolves coming into the city, or are they pretty much out?
Well, wolves do get into some urbanized areas. Northern Wisconsin, probably more commonly, places like the city of Superior has a fairly large area of public forest land that I believe there's a pack that occurs right within the city limits there of Superior. So we do, I think, in the outskirts of Rhinelander, where Brad lives, I'm sure wolves occasionally pass through some of those areas. But our larger cities like Madison, Green Bay, Milwaukee, I think it'd be pretty unlikely for wolves to wander into those cities.
I'm curious, Brad, if these animals, as they drift into cities, if they become more used to humans, if they become less frightened of us. And I'm asking because we see a lot of raccoons in Wausau. You mentioned how prevalent they are in a lot of communities. And they don't seem too afraid of us. Do they become more used to us and less frightened over time?
Yeah, they certainly can, become habituated, lose that fear of humans, depending on the amount of engagement and interaction they do have with humans, and that's why it's particularly important to limit your interaction with wildlife in urban areas and even harass and haze those animals so you maintain that fear of humans. Some of the big things to do are, watch, and as Adrian mentioned too, watch, those potential food sources out there. So like bird feeders, your garbage cans and grills, things like that, try to limit those attractants, that cause wildlife to come to your yard, try to limit that stuff. And turn, that obviously makes that wild animal look for natural food sources rather than those human provided food sources. So you want to do that. And then obviously, like I mentioned, harass or haze those animals when you see them. Make sure you yell at them. You can throw sticks or rocks at them, as long as you're not physically harming them. Yell, kind of reinforce that fear of humans to make sure that they have that flee response, when they do see humans and you don't have that that comfortableness and that up close and personal engagement with a wild animal.
We'll talk a little bit more about prevention techniques in just a little bit as well. You're listening to Adrian Weideman and Brad Cooley as we continue our discussion on coexisting with bears, coyotes, foxes, and other wildlife on Route 51. Coming up, why animals become aggressive and how to protect yourself and your property. Your questions are welcome. Give us a call at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51. On Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Brad Cooley and Adrian Weideman are with us today as we discuss close encounters with Wisconsin's many wild creatures and how to avoid them. You're welcome to join in the discussion and ask your own questions, too. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can join by phone. The number to call, 800-780-9742. One big thing that was in the news very recently in the Medford area, a Wisconsin couple killed a bear that attacked them inside their home. They spotted it eating from their bird feeder. The Taylor County Sheriff's Department said the couple told police that the bear charged through a window after they yelled at it to go away. Brad, what do we know about this incident so far?
Yeah, very unfortunate and rare occurrence, you know. Just like you said, you know, they about 11 p.m. at night, they saw two bears at their bird feeder. They yelled through the window to try to scare them away. The one bear fled like they typically would and do. The other bear turned and came and entered the house through the window. And you know, ultimately, they had to shoot it inside the home. So pretty rare occurrence and very unfortunate. Luckily, you know, they weren't seriously injured, you know, had some scratches and required some stitches. But, you know, fortunately, you know, could have been a lot worse and happy that no one got seriously injured. But, yeah, responses like that are rare, but they do happen. You know, these are wild animals. You know, the report was that second bear that was involved in that was likely a yearling bear. It was big enough and tall enough to be able to reach bird feeder, so it doesn't indicate it was a cub. A lot of times, you know, if there are cubs present, that sow will protect that cub, you know, so that was one thought, you know, was that was a cub and maybe the mother of the sow was defending that cub, but that was not the case in this situation, at least with the information we have. Another potential option is that bear was defending that food source. You know, it felt threatened when the woman yelled at the bear. It felt threatened and just responded by, you know, running at the house. The bird feeder was approximately 15 feet away from the home. You know, so it could have been a reaction to protecting that food source. It could have been just a reaction from being startled. You know, that bear was eating and all of a sudden there was a noise or someone yelling at it and it could have been just a reaction to being startled. So nonetheless, a very unfortunate situation and just kind of reinforces that, you know, these are wild animals and you never know how they're going to react.
Adrian, as Brad said, this was kind of an unusual incident for this kind of situation. Bears apparently not usually this aggressive, but what kinds of things in general can trigger that aggression?
Well, certainly the food source is a big factor here. And people are urged that if they live in areas where there are bears present, that don't leave bird food out overnight. If you're going to feed birds, you probably need to take it in at night. And there really isn't a great need to feed birds in the summertime when there's lots of wild flowers, wild plants, insects and things available, wild seeds. So there's really not a need to feed birds in the summertime. If people really want to do that so they can attract and see the birds near their home, they really need to bring in those feeders at night so they're not present and attracting bears. But you know, people should focus more on planting a variety of shrubbery, native plants, native wildflowers to attract birds and get away from the feeder during the summertime.
Also, Adrian, cougars have come up a couple of times so far in this program, and I know cougar sightings have been reported sporadically in the region, not necessarily in urban areas, though. Are there any updates on that? What kinds of potential problems does that pose?
So far, we've had cougars pass through Wisconsin. We've identified specific individuals going back to 2008. One of those eventually did end up getting killed in downtown Chicago. So they do occasionally travel through urban areas. And there's been some interesting stories in Los Angeles of cougars living very close to people. But we haven't had that situation in Wisconsin. And I'm not aware that it's been any kind of a encounter of cougars. So they're mostly just adult males, sub-adult males passing through the state searching for females and kind of going in the wrong direction, because if they head eastward, they're not likely to find females. They're coming from places like the Black Hills of South Dakota, the Badlands of North Dakota, or the Platte River areas of Nebraska.
Brad, what about other animals like foxes and wolves? When do they become aggressive toward humans?
We have very few cases of fox becoming aggressive. You know, even coyotes, you know, some people do report, you know, aggressive fox or coyotes, but in most cases, it's just the animal being curious and not necessarily fleeing right away. you know, that animals sometimes get curious and approach, and it's not an aggressive manner or aggressive type response, that they're just curious, you know. So very few conflicts of you know, coyotes and fox, you know, becoming aggressive. Wolves the same, you know, very few cases. We do each year have, you know, some human health and safety conflicts that are verified, you know, for wolves. In most cases, those aren't necessarily aggressive behavior of wolves, but it's just wolves that are, you know, present in close proximity to folks in occupied dwellings. You know, we've had some cases where wolves will depredate livestock, you know, within the yard of the home, or come within, you know, feet of a home and you know, where people recreate or have kids playing and stuff like that. So those aggressive reports are very rare. In most cases, it's just the presence of an animal a lot of times that triggers that response, and everyone's comfortableness or you know, how they feel around wildlife is different. You know, if I see a fox or coyote or wolf, you know, my response is probably be different from somebody that's not used to dealing with those animals. So, you know, personal comfort, you know, varies a lot, you know, and how somebody responds.
And Brad, let's circle back to the bear issue. In a nutshell, how do we coexist with them? What's the best thing to do if we come across a bear in our on our property, in our yard? How do you handle it?
Yeah, you know, the bear population is extremely healthy. You know, in Wisconsin, we have, you know, estimated over 24,000 bear in the state. So there's a lot of bear in the state, a lot of you know, interaction between people and bear. Each year, DNR partners with USDA Wildlife Services to respond to bear complaints. We get 700-800 complaints a year. And most of those complaints, you know, can be resolved with just altering your habits around your home. You know, the big thing, like Adrian mentioned and we had discussed earlier, is removing attractants, you know, whether that's a bird feeder, whether that's, you know, keeping your garbage inaccessible, not putting it out till the morning of pickup, making sure your grill's clean of food residue, not feeding pets outside, you know, removing those attractants, you know, because in a lot of cases, that's why the wildlife is there. You know, there's a food attractant, food reward there, and that brings them in closer proximity to humans. So if you can remove those attractants, in a lot of cases, you can prevent any negative interaction with wildlife.
Adrian, I've heard that making noise scares bears away, but then I've also read the opposite, that we're attracting attention when we do that. So, I mean, in your opinion, what's the right approach?
I think making noise, waving hands, making a commotion yourself, is standing as tall as you can. All of those things contribute to scaring off bears. Bears in general are fearful of people, and the more aggressive we look, the more vicious we look, the more likely they're just going to run away.
Brett, how do you recommend dealing with wild animals that are invading the garden? This is a common problem. I mean, you know, the lettuce is gone. The flowers are gone. How do you recommend dealing with that?
Yeah, very common problem, you know, whether it's woodchucks or rabbits or deer, you know. You know, what I typically recommend, you know, you want to look for a long-term solution. You know, if you're like me, you're going to plant the garden, you know, number of years, you know, it's not just the 1 year. So you want to look for a long-term solution if you can. You know, it might be a little more cost up front, but you want to look for a long-term solution. What I recommend, you know, is fencing, some type of a barrier to keep those animals out. You know, they have different wire mesh sizes, you know, depending on the animal you're dealing with. So if it's rabbits, you know, you can have a smaller mesh size, you know, to keep those rabbits out. You know, if it's deer, there's fences that are 6-7 foot high, you know, that keep deer out. So yeah, you want to look for a long-term solution. So fencing's a great one. You know, if you're looking for shorter term, you know, you can certainly use repellents, motion activated lights. You know, they even have motion activated sprinklers now that work really well for repelling and keeping wildlife away. So there's a variety of non-lethal alternatives out there, you know, to prevent those issues.
Well, and obviously fencing can keep some animals out, but maybe not the big ones like bears. Adrian, how do you keep bears out of your property? I mean, obviously it's, you know, keeping those bird feeders away and the food sources away, but is there a way that you can kind of prevent them, give a good barrier to keep them out?
I think fencing still works, but probably you want to deal with electric fencing with bears, and especially if it's like honey situation. My garden, I have electric netting around it that I take down in the fall and put back up in the spring, and I use a solar charger to charge that. And I've never had problems with bears in there, and it mostly keeps the deer out, except if the battery runs down and I hadn't discovered it. And some years ago, I did find that I found out afterwards that the battery had run down and the deer had figured it out because they're coming in at night. When I put up a trail camera in the middle of the garden, they showed me that they love to eat tomatoes. They would chew the tomatoes right in front of the camera in my garden. So those work very well if the battery is working.
Brad, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, electric fencing works extremely well for bear. In Wisconsin, we have the Wildlife Damage Abatement and Claims Program, which is a program that helps agricultural producers deal with, you know, damages from deer, bear, elk, turkey, and geese. And through that program, we have over 800 electric fences, you know, on the landscape that are designed to protect apiaries, you know, whether that's pollen, pollination, or whether that's honey production, but over 800 fences out on the landscape to protect those apiaries from bear damage. Even personally, we have a friend that keeps a few beehives on our property, and we have that protected with electric fencing. And as long as the, you know, the batteries are charged or you're, you know, make sure you have power, you know, that works very well for protecting, you know, gardens or apiaries or, you know, even livestock from bears.
And Brad, you live kind of right in the middle of wolf country. So how do you repel wolves from your property if you're in an area that sees a lot of that kind of activity?
Yeah. Yep. You know, a lot of folks probably aren't aware, but we do a lot of non-lethal wolf abatement. You know, kind of the standard thing we use is called turboflagry, which is electrified flagging that goes around livestock pastures. The electric's not really intended for deterring wolves. The flagging is more intended to deter the wolves, but the electric is more designed to contain cattle and livestock and stuff. So we use a bunch of turboflagry out on the landscape. You know, again, we partner with USDA Wildlife Services to implement that abatement. We have one project up in Douglas County. We have a 6-strand electric fence that is designed to keep wolves out of a calving pasture up there. Another area we use fox lights, which are just a flashing kind of strobe light that flashes in different patterns and provides a visual deterrent that the wolves aren't used to seeing. You know, that can sometimes work. You know, we have scare wire, which is electrified wire that goes all the way around the perimeter of pastures, about, you know, 8 to 10 inches off the ground to keep the wolves out of there. That works. And then more recently, we've actually have invested in predator-proof fencing. So we've a project in northern Price County. We've implemented a 6-foot-high woven wire fence with a 42-inch apron to prevent, you know, coyotes or fox or wolves from digging under. More of a long-term solution there, more of a, you know, more costly solution, but you know, at this point it's been 100% effective at keeping wolves and other predators out. We're also this fall or actually this summer going to be trialing flashing ear tags. So, you know, it's another visual deterrent where we're going to tag calves with these flashing ear tags that, you know, once they're motion activated, so once a calf would start running, that light would start blinking. And again, that's a visual deterrent that the wolves aren't used to it, and that may deter depredation. So, yeah, there's a whole variety of non-lethal abatement that we're incorporating and utilizing on the landscape to prevent conflicts.
Adrian, Brad talked a little bit about the lights, and we talked earlier about motion-activated sprinklers. Other people put wind chimes in their yard. Does that help keep animals away on a long-term basis, or is the effect only temporary? Do they get used to those things?
I think you do have to constantly reinforce them and switch things around. You can't rely on just one procedure all the time and expect it always to work. I know the first time I had woodchuck problems in my yard, I just got a decoy of a coyote, and that worked really well. But then after a while, I tried using that with deer, and first day or so, it scared them away. After a while, I could see footprints of deer right next to my coyote decoy. So they got used to it. So you have to mix these things around, move them around some, make sure that you're varying the stimulus from time to time so it's not exact same thing all the time.
Brad, what about raccoons in the attic? We mentioned that earlier. If they're in the attic, under the house, or porch, is there a safe way to remove them? What should people do?
Yeah, a lot of cases for raccoons, you know, live trapping works extremely well. They're easy to trap, you know, using cat food or you know, some similar attractant like that, you know, so they're easy to trap and get out. You know, they can be relocated on private property with landowner permission. They cannot be, you know, released on DNR property without landowner permission. So just want to make that clear. But yeah, live trapping works extremely well for a lot of, you know, the common species that folks will deal with, you know, skunks, possums, you know, raccoons, things like that. But, you know, live trapping and moving that animal or removing that animal is just, you know, part of the equation. You know, obviously if that animal's underneath your porch or up in your attic, you know, it got there somehow. So, you know, the exclusion is the other important thing to remember is, you know, once you've removed that animal, you know, you want to prevent additional animals from getting in there. So, you know, fixing those spots or eliminating those spots where animals are accessing your house, you know, you want to be sure to do that as well to prevent additional issues.
Adrian, what advice do you have about skunks? I mean, there is obviously the live trapping thing, but then you're risking getting sprayed, right? Is there another option to get them out?
I haven't had a lot of problems with skunks, but the few I've dealt with, I had live trapped, and just have to be careful to put a cover over the trap after you catch them, handle them carefully, and take them to a place where you can release them or euthanize them in some fashion or other. But one of the things is not leaving a lot of junk around, places where they can hide under rotten buildings, buildings that are dilapidated, the kind of places that can provide structure and denning for them. Cleaning up places like that reduces the risk of skunks hanging out. I know when the home that my wife and I occupied first had some old outbuildings, and those seem to be favorite hangouts for skunks. And we removed those, cleaned those up, and we haven't had skunk problems since then.
Brad, it sounds like the recurring theme I'm hearing here is that prevention is the best option. Is that the case?
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah, the last thing you want is to have to, you know, try to resolve a conflict once it's started. So, yeah, prevention goes a long way, whether it's, you know, like Adrian mentioned, making sure your yard's clean of, you know, debris piles or anything where a skunk or raccoon or, you know, woodchuck might like, you know, repairing your house, make sure your house is in good repair to make sure animals can't access it and get in your attic and stuff like that. So, yeah, doing preventative measures is certainly the key to this to try to avoid and prevent, you know, any of those wildlife conflicts.
You're listening to Brad Cooley and Adrian Whitehaven on Route 51 for a discussion on how to handle foxes, coyotes, bears, and other wild animals in urban settings. Coming up, what to do if you or a pet have direct contact with wild animals, and a little bit more about what the law says about hunting and trapping these species. If you have a question for our guests, you're welcome to join in. Give us a call at 800-780-9742. You can also send an email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward with our guests, Adrian Whitehaven and Brad Cooley, for a discussion on avoiding conflicts with bears, foxes, wolves, and other wild animals so prevalent in Wisconsin. If you have questions for our guests, email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can join us by phone by calling 800-780-9742. We talked a little bit earlier about skunks. When I was growing up, our dog had a tangle with a skunk, and it was a big old mess. I'll never forget it. But besides the mess, are skunks worrisome from an illness standpoint, a disease-carrying standpoint? What is it that we should be worried about, or shouldn't we, Brad?
Yeah, for skunks, you know, the big thing is would be rabies, you know, concern there. You know, if the skunk's not behaving correctly, has some kind of neurological issues like that, there's always concern of rabies. We have not had very many cases of rabies in skunks, but it is a concern with skunks as well as, you know, fox and coyotes and bear and other mammals as well. So, yeah, rabies certainly comes to my mind as a potential concern, and that can be to you or your pet, you know. So, yeah, important to keep those wildlife diseases in mind, too, when you do encounter one.
Adrian, are some animals more likely to carry rabies, or is this a concern with all wildlife?
It is to some extent a concern with all warm-blooded animals that can potentially carry rabies, more commonly in mammals. But skunk is probably, I believe, the number one or carrier of rabies in Wisconsin. So, yeah, if you see an ill-acting skunk, a sick-acting skunk, you should suspect the possibility of rabies. And that's perhaps almost more of a concern with skunks than the bad smell that it can give your dog.
Peggy is calling from northern Wisconsin, and she has a question. Welcome, Peggy.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to know?
I have a porcupine chewing on my garage door for the past 3 weeks. Usually comes at night, but it has been here during the day. I've used several different things and called the Wildlife Center in Minocqua for advice. But yeah, it's still chewing on the door.
Okay. So Peggy wants to know what to do about a porcupine who is feasting on her garage door. She's tried several different things. What's the best way to handle that? Adrian, what are your thoughts?
I don't know if there's any kind of covering that can be placed on the garage so to make it less palatable. Sometimes it may just be that porcupine needs to be euthanized. They're usually not an overly abundant animal, so normally if you remove one porcupine, there's not likely to be a bunch of others behind, whereas unlike something like rabbits, where you kill off one rabbit, there's still going to be plenty of others. So it may be, I don't know if there's any, Brad might have some other idea, but I don't know if there's any kind of covering that you might be able to place on the garage that might make it distasteful for the porcupine.
It's interesting. A friend of mine just showed me pictures who lives in Rhinelander and has the same problem going on in their home with a porcupine chewing on the garage or on the wood during the night. So, Brad, how do you handle it?
Yeah, it's pretty common occurrence. You know, a lot of times it's a treated wood or plywoods that have kind of, you know, I'm not sure what glue material is in there, but it's porcupines like to chew on it. You know, if it's a salty flavor of it or what, but porcupines like it. But, you know, like Adrian said, you know, exclusion, if it's a, you know, a deck structure, we've had complaints of porcupines chewing on deck structure. So yeah, if you can fence that off, make that inaccessible to porcupines, that would work. I'm not aware of any fumigants. The other thing to do is, you know, either lethally trap or live trap. You know, porcupines are considered unprotected species here in Wisconsin. So you can live trap porcupines, usually some, you know, some tomatoes, some lettuce, some vegetables like that work pretty well for attracting porcupines into a live trap. And then, you know, you can relocate it. Otherwise, you know, lethal control is an option, you know, whether that's trapping or shooting porcupines. But, you know, like Adrian also mentioned, it's typically one porcupine. You know, you don't have family groups or problems with multiple porcupines causing problems. So typically, once you get rid of that one animal, you know, you've resolved your issue in most cases.
What does the law say about hunting or trapping these animals if they migrate onto our property, or does it differ depending on whether you live in a city or out in the country? Brad, what's the law?
Yeah, it depends on the wildlife species. You know, for most of the common species, fox, coyotes, raccoons, woodchucks, you know, landowners can have the ability to trap or shoot those animals year round, you know, if they're on their property. If they're not experienced or feel comfortable trapping or shooting those animals, you know, then they can hire someone to do that, whether it's an animal control company or a friend or family member. You know, they can have someone else do that. That individual would need a valid small game license if they're going to shoot the animal, or a valid trapping license if they're going to trap it. You know, so for most of those wildlife species that folks deal with, you know, state statute, state law allows them to resolve those issues. Some of the other species like deer, you know, maybe turkey issues, bear issues, you know, they're permits that are needed, you know, for anyone to, you know, try to lethally remove any of those type of animals or even live trap those type of animals. So it depends on the species. You know, so in addition to state law, you also need to look at your local ordinances. You know, a lot of municipalities have local ordinances that either prevent firearm discharge or prevent trapping. So even though state law might allow it, you still, you know, it's always recommended to look at those local ordinances as well to make sure that whatever removal method you're going to be utilizing, that it is allowed through local ordinance as well.
Brad, at what point should the DNR be called in for help?
Yeah, again, it depends on the species. You know, there's a lot of misconception that DNR staff will come out there and remove an animal for folks. That's not the case. You know, if it's a case of bear or you know, wolves or something like that, then, you know, we do provide assistance and have options to try to remove that animal for you. But for those common species, you know, like, you know, raccoons, woodchucks, you know, the porcupine cases, you know, landowners have the ability to resolve them issues themselves or, you know, hire a wildlife damage control operator to assist them.
Let's circle back to the rabies issue. We talked about this briefly earlier. Is there a clear way to know if an animal we encounter has rabies? I know, Adrian, you said, you know, you look for, you know, if they're behaving oddly, but what are some signs that we should be concerned about rabies in an animal?
Lethargic behavior, moving about slowly, not seeming to know what it's doing sometimes. It's just kind of bumping into things. Sometimes the foaming at the mouth can be a characteristic that excessive salivation is a problem. Sometimes it's they're near dead by the time you've noticed that this is a sick animal. So, but the only way you can confirm it is by having them actually tested. Any animal that's suspected of having rabies, you have to be careful not to handle it, wearing only rubber gloves, putting in a plastic bag, and make sure it's properly handled before it gets sent to a place for having it tested. But yeah, those kind of behaviors where they're acting very lethargic, their lack of any fear of people, they don't seem to, they're out in the middle of the day at times that they normally wouldn't be active, or unusual behaviors like that.
Brad, are there other diseases that these animals carry that can pose a risk to humans or domestic animals?
Yeah, there's a few other diseases that come to my mind. One is canine distemper. You know, that has a lot of the same characteristics or you know, symptoms as rabies, you know, kind of that lethargic, you know, and bumping around, you know, a lot of those neurological symptoms like that. So canine distemper, you know, and that can impact raccoons, fox, coyotes, wolves. You know, the other big concern there is, you know, if your domestic dog, if your pet becomes too close, you know, to those animals, they can get canine distemper as well. You know, fortunately, we have vaccinations for that, you know, but canine distemper is one. Canine parvovirus, wolves, coyotes, again, domestic dogs can get that. That's an intestinal disease. You know, so that's another disease that comes to my mind. Mange is another one. We've detected mange, particularly sarcoptic mange in red fox, coyotes, wolves. Mange can infect humans, although it's pretty rare, but, you know, that's another one to be concerned about. You know, raccoons have a lot of parasites and bacteria that they carry. So raccoon roundworm's another one, you know, that folks can get. Fortunately for a lot of these, you know, proper hygiene and good precautionary care is you know, prevents a lot of issues with these diseases. So yeah, when you're handling an animal, you know, make sure you use rubber gloves, you know, and throw it away. And then of course, when you're done, you know, wash your hands with soap and water very thoroughly to you know, kill some of that bacteria. So yeah, there's a whole variety of you know, wildlife diseases that are out there. If folks are interested in a more comprehensive list, we have a great wildlife diseases webpage on the DNR's website that individuals can go to look at those diseases, look at the symptoms, the signs, how they're transmitted, and of course, how they're treated. So great resource for people.
Adrian, what about bats? Are they a nuisance? Are they a danger? Or are they something that we should welcome into our properties?
For most part, we should welcome them in. Bats have been doing poorly in Wisconsin with the outbreak of white nose syndrome, in especially our cave bats, and it's drastically reduced bat abundance. I know I'm not seeing bats in my yard the way I had seen 5-10 years ago, that their populations are under stress right now. Several species are listed as threatened. I guess the long-eared bat is becoming listed as an endangered species. So they are suffering great losses, and they are very important as far as their control on insect populations that probably reduce abundance of injurious insects. So we want to encourage bats, and have people build bat houses is a great idea to encourage bats to your area. The only concern would be is if you find like a sick bat laying on the sidewalk or laying on a driveway, not to pick that up with your hands, or a bat that looks like it's almost dead. There's some risk there of being bitten by it. But for most part, bats are very beneficial animals, and we really want to encourage and support healthy bat populations.
Adrian, if you do see a bat like that, who that's obviously injured or ill and lying on the pavement, who do you call?
I'm not sure if DNR will handle those, Brad, right now. Is that something, or would have to go through Department of Health for reporting those right now?
Correct. Yeah, that would go through the Department of Health at this point. Yeah, you could submit that for testing potentially. Bats are a great resource, as Adrian indicated. You know, they help with pollination, insect control, things like that. Right now, the big brown bat, the little brown, northern long-eared, and then the eastern pipistrelle is they're classified as threatened in the state because of white nose syndrome and the declining bat population. So anything we can do to protect bats is certainly it is certainly a good thing. Right now they are listed as threatened, which means that, you know, legally you're not supposed to kill bats. There is a broad incidental take permit that does allow for some bat control in cases of, public health concerns, or, you know, removing bats from homes and offices or building demolitions, things like that. But for the most part, you know, you should try to avoid killing any bats. Exclusion is what you want to focus on if you can. There is even a period of time where June 1st, August 15th, where you shouldn't even try exclusion just because the bats have pups and you don't want to, separate those pups from the adults. But exclusion is, you know, basically where a lot of cases you'll put a one-way door on the side of a building, you know, where the bats can exit, but they can't re-enter the building. So exclusion is what you want to focus on if at all possible. You know, you want to avoid any type of lethal control for bats, and working through a experienced animal control operator, they'll know many of those rules and regulations for bat control and be a great resource for helping homeowners.
Adrian, I read an academic paper, it was published 2 years ago, that said scholarship on human-wildlife interactions has focused mainly on conflict, which has been a constraint to wildlife conservation. The authors say that centering attention on reducing negative interactions rather than on increasing positive relations between humans and wildlife can be problematic. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think there are better solutions ahead or better ways to study this?
Well, I think, you know, certainly this program today is about the conflicts, but in the long run, we want to be able to enjoy the wildlife around our homes. And for the most part, the wildlife we see are not going to be causing damage. And the things I talked about, planting native shrubbery, planting native perennial plants, wildflowers, prairie grasses, if you're in southern Wisconsin, creating wild spaces within your yard and enjoying the wildlife, and not to overly worry about them. Be cautious and avoid conflicts where you can, but at the same time, enjoy having a diversity of wildlife around your home.
And yeah, Brad, would you like to add to that?
Yeah. I recently was talking with Dr. David Drake. Dr. Drake heads up a project called the Urban Canid Project, which is out of UW-Madison, where they track coyote and fox movements around Dane County, in particular around Madison. And, if folks want to look at that, there's a map where people have reported fox and coyote sightings around the city of Madison, and it's incredible. In most cases, these animals are coexisting with us, living with us, and we don't know about it. You know, one of the things that stuck out to me that he said is that, you know, 90% of reported interactions with wildlife are positive, you know, where they observe the animals, see them, you know, and then they go on. Human goes one way, the animal goes the other, and it's a positive encounter. So, you know, that's the thing to focus on here is, you know, obviously we're looking at some of the negative impacts, but, you know, there's a lot of positive interaction going on out there as well.
You're listening to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward, extending a sincere thanks to our guests, Adrian Wideven and Brad Cootie. Our producers are Joy Ratch-Kramer and Kate Spranger. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program, as well as our previous programs, at WPR.org/Route51. You can also subscribe to our podcast. It's available from your favorite platform. If you have an idea for a future program, email us at ideas@WPR.org. We would love to hear from you. Next week, we'll be back with another fascinating discussion, and we hope you'll join us. Until then, we're heading out of town.